So the last session that I'm presenting today is on something that kind of builds on what we've seen earlier, but is really quite an important piece of work as far as we're concerned, but also as far as the Financial Services Authority is concerned. Basically, this is the output from a project that we did for the FSA on appropriate prudential policy tightening. What is the appropriate level of bank capital and bank liquidity that we can detect using empirical methods? And basically, they gave us this commission at the National Institute. What you saw in the previous second half was part of the output from that. But what you'll see is that it combines with quite a lot of other stuff in order to try and draw some solutions about how much bank capital and bank liquidity should be tightened. And this has now come out as a FSA occasional paper, and I think it's fair to say that it's entered the policy debate in the UK quite well. And I would hope that it might be of relevance internationally as well. Okay, so basically, regulators in the wake of the financial crisis are interested in tightening regulation. They can see that the levels of capital and the levels of liquidity in particular prior to the subprime crisis were not appropriate. And the reason that we want to do that in the long term, as it says here, is that we can reduce the probability of a costly financial crisis if we can if we increase these variables. So that's the benefit. And tomorrow I shall be looking in one session at estimates of the cost of financial crisis, in particular on consumption and investment, based on some past research I've done. What we can all agree, I think, is that financial crises are costly, and it would be good to reduce the likelihood of them. But you don't get a free lunch from a regulatory tightening, because the regulatory tightening may reduce output because it raises the borrowing costs for both households and companies. In other words, because we're in effect taxing banks by raising the required level of liquidity, raising the required level of capital, they are going to respond by widening spreads between borrowing and lending rates, which means that households get less on their interest, on their deposits, and loans are going to cost more, and that in turn will have an impact on the wider economy. And what we're doing then is we're going to estimate those benefits and costs of raising capital and liquidity in terms of those precise factors, namely probability of crises on the one hand, and their costs, and higher spreads on the other hand. And what we come out with is, as we say, a positive net benefit from a substantial tightening of bank regulation, although the precise optimal level will depend on the assumptions we make. So that's what we're going to do. We'll look a bit at the literature, at crisis prediction, which is mainly to do with what I've just shown you, that equation for the OECD countries, impact of the crisis. We have to model the banking system to get costs out, and then we seek to combine the two together. As I say, this is National Institute research for the FSA, and Ray Barrell, Tatiana Feek, Dawn Holland, Simon Kirby, and Ioana Liadzi have all been co-authors with me. So I don't want to claim any sole authorship here. What we're doing then first is we're looking at the literature, on bank behavior relative to capital and liquidity regulation, assessing the link to probabilities, which is what, in a sense, I've already told you. What are the long-run costs of crises? And that's very important. We talk about a concept called scarring. Scarring means that the economy has a long-run downside from a financial crisis. It's not just something that it recovers back up from, as we'll see. Modelling the banks and seeing what sort of range of net benefits there are to the regulatory tightening. So this slide is very brief on the literature, and if you look at the literature on bank capital, it's in this discussion paper, that bit I did write. You'll find that a lot of theoretical work on bank capital doesn't really talk very much about regulation. It just talks about corporate finance incentives for banks to hold this or that capital. Talking about people like Tyrol, Holmstrom, etc., have written on that area. The most relevant work that we found on in the existing literature is on bank capital buffers. The idea that banks build up a sort of protection for themselves from capital to protect themselves against shocks. She's mainly theoretical stuff by people like Alistair Milne at City University. The other one is work mainly done at the Bank of England and the FSA, where they look at a panel of banks, usually with their actual capital and the trigger ratios. You remember what I said about trigger ratios? Trigger ratios are levels of capital adequacy that are defined by the UK regulator for each bank individually, and those are levels when capital falls below that level, the authorities will pile into the bank, and the bank seeks to avoid going below the trigger ratio for that reason at any cost. So the bank always wants to have a certain excess of its capital over the trigger ratio. And you can see this illustrated on the next chart. This chart shows us the asset-weighted trigger ratio, that's the bottom line, for the whole banking system. And what you can see is it's not hugely above 8%, but it is above it, and it would be slightly lower for the largest banks and substantially higher for the smaller ones. That's just an asset-weighted trigger ratio. And the UK authorities enforce that quite strictly. And what you can see there is that the UK banking system seeks to maintain a risk-weighted capital adequacy about 3.5 percentage points above the trigger ratio. And when the trigger ratio rises, as it did here, so does the risk-adjusted capital adequacy. And obviously here we're going back to the time when Basel was introduced in the first place in 1988. But even during the crisis period of the early 90s, they still sought to build up their risk-weighted capital. And so the work that I'm talking about in this third bullet about regulation is that they find that trigger ratios are firstly the main determinant of capital. If a bank's trigger ratio goes up, its capital goes up because they want what we could call headroom over the trigger ratio. So no matter how big the shock, they don't go below the trigger ratio. And also that changes in the trigger ratios actually affect loan supply from the banks. So they were able to detect a rise in trigger ratio leading to the bank being more restrictive in terms of its lending. And that's exactly what I guess we would expect from rising regulatory demand for capital. So that's an important area of work, and if you're interested, We reference them in our paper. These are purely UK results from the authorities who've done econometrics in this area using a panel of individual banks. That's quite confidential data that they just use themselves, but they show the results in these pieces of work. Our next work area in the literature looks at the overall pro-cyclicality of capital and the balance sheet, and also the impact of the introduction of Basel in the early 1990s, what we call the credit crunch. And that is obviously something we've discussed now, but there's been quite a lot of work in that area. The United States in particular, people were very excited, and there was a lot of economic and academic research in the early 90s as to whether the introduction of Basel had caused a credit crunch in the United States in 91, 92, what they called the period of headwinds. And there was a conclusion, I think, on balance from people like Berger, etc., that it may well have done. A fifth area of work on bank capital is work that has done global databases of banks' behavior, and I think in particular of, again, Mirko Kant and Heusinger. But also Bicker, some of you may know him from the Dutch Central Bank, a very good researcher, and who. These are work on cross-country data sets looking at the impact of capitalization on margins. And I'm going to just jump briefly to show you something in this context, which is from a lecture that is going to happen tomorrow, which is going to be quite long. Let me just go, where are we? Here. Okay. This is actually lecture 9. And the reason this is interesting, I'm going to have to go through it. Ah, no. You can't rush Microsoft PowerPoint. Why is this interesting? Okay, this is part 2 of lecture 9. Why is this interesting? Basically, Haibin Zhu and I were doing some work that we'll tell you about tomorrow, the main focus of which is this thing at the bottom. What is the impact of commercial property prices on banks' behavior? What I want to illustrate to you now, though, is this row here, which is capital ratio minus 1. You may be able to get to it. It's in the lecture tomorrow morning if you want to get there, but otherwise just look at the screen for the moment. Basically, this is illustrating the sorts of results that people get, like those guys. We had quite a decent sample here. We had 974 banks from 1989 to 2002. The BIS managed to splice together two lots of bank scope. And this is your core result, this one here. The capital ratio has a positive and extremely significant effect on NIM, which is the net interest margin. Okay, so the higher the capital adequacy ratio, the higher the net interest margin. You have to be careful with what this result is actually telling you, because we don't, unlike the FSA and the bank, have the interaction between regulation and banks' chosen capital adequacy. Okay. This is just whatever bank scope says capital adequacy is. But what you can see is this core result. If you have more capital, banks' margins are wider. What you can also see, the more capital banks have, the less the non-performing loans, suggesting a sort of positive moral hazard result. If a bank has more capital, it's more likely to be careful in terms of allowing itself to have non-performing loans. The more capital a bank has, as you might expect, the higher its profitability, because profitability feeds into retentions that generate non-capital adequacy. And at a low level of significance over here, the bank is also more able to provide if it has a higher capital adequacy. So I'm just showing you that to illustrate that you can get quite sensible results from capital adequacy estimation in extremely large panels. We've got 4,000 to 5,000 observations there with the sorts of results that we might expect from economic intuition. So that's my own work, which contributes to this area, cross-country work showing impact of capitalization on margins. The FSA, as well as other people in the UK who have an academic background, tend to get very excited about the Modigliani-Miller theorem. And as you know, the Modigliani-Miller theorem says that under certain circumstances, the capital structure of a firm has no impact on its real behavior. And so they say, if Modigliani-Miller holds, why should capital adequacy, which after all is the authorities forcing the debt equity ratio to be something possibly other than the bank would have chosen, why should that have a real effect? Why should it affect lending? Why should it affect margins, etc., etc.? But our argument would be that Modigliani and Miller is unlikely to hold in the case of banks, partly because of regulation itself, but also it assumes perfect capital markets. There are various assumptions in there that aren't held. And the result that you just saw, that for 1,000 banks worldwide, capital adequacy raises margins, is directly contrary, one can argue, to MM. And then finally, there's the developing literature on crisis probabilities, which I've just shown you an example of, and which is an input to this work as well. Okay, so this chart we've already seen. Predicting crises, I won't spend time on this because it's what I talked to you in the second half of the last lecture, but just to remind you, most work on crises uses Logit, uses a global sample. It correlates it with macro, banking sector, and institutional variables, like the sorts of things we talked about, as well as deposit insurance. By the way, I didn't put deposit insurance in the Asian estimate, nor in the OECD estimate that you saw in the last lecture, because, excuse me, it was present for the countries in all cases. But when you do use a global sample, as I said, deposit insurance is an indicator of a raising of probability of crises, and financial liberalization is also an indicator of a rise in the probability of crises. And as we said in the number six lecture, the traditional crisis models did not pick up the risks that were building up because they didn't include the household debt or house prices. They didn't talk about securitization or regulatory aspects. And so we come here to input the same equation that you saw in the last session, with a negative effect of unweighted capital adequacy, LEV, a negative effect of liquidity, broad liquidity to assets, LIQA, positive effect of real house price growth, lag 3 periods. And what we're doing here is we're doing a different kind of exercise that is of an immediate relevance to financial regulation. What we're doing here is we're saying, use that equation and calculate the probability of a, should be crisis, not a crisis, in 2007. And you can see there, remember our cutoff we decided was 0.032, which is the system mean, the sample mean. You can see there that France, Italy, Spain, and the UK are all predicting crises using that criterion. Germany and the United States are not. Okay. So you remember the table with the X's, these are the actual probabilities that underlie those X's in terms of predicting crises in 2007. What we're doing though is to then say, well, what if liquidity and leverage, liquidity and unweighted capital adequacy that is, were higher in 2007 than they actually were, using that equation here, leaving house prices as they are. And as you would expect, because they've got a negative sign, the more you raise liquidity and the more you raise unadjusted capital adequacy, the lower the price's probability is. What the equation is saying is that if you raise them 1%, then you only expect a crisis in France and the UK. If you raise them 2%, it's only the UK. If you raise them 3%, the UK is almost gone as well. So this is very rough, but you can see immediately that using this equation, we get a kind of ready retina of reduction in crisis probabilities that can help encourage the authorities to go and tighten capital adequacy policy and liquidity as well. And let me just add that in the same way that the authorities forgot about liquidity, the academic community didn't take much notice of it either. When I talked about this literature, there's virtually no work on costs or benefits of higher liquidity. It's all about capital adequacy. There's virtually no work on liquidity at all. Similarly to the authorities not taking much notice of it either. So, commenting on the results, which I won't do in detail because I've already talked about it, we use unadjusted capital adequacy because we don't have risk adjusted partly, although we also think that unadjusted might be quite a good idea because it doesn't hide things so easily. Changing capital is twice as effective as liquidity. Substantial reduction in crises from regulatory tightening, but a weaker effect in the United States. And as I said earlier, if we could only measure off balance sheet properly, perhaps we could estimate an equation that would have predicted the crisis in the US. Maybe not. I guess one point about the United States is that, as you know, the banking system has got an awful lot of little banks. And so if we only had data for the largest banks, I suspect the data might well have predicted the crisis. But because we have data for the whole banking system, including the Third National Bank of Smallville, Dakota, who probably didn't get into subprime or CDOs, that may be one reason why it's quite hard to predict the US crisis. Any questions or comments? Okay. What we want to do then, so that's one input, the piece of work we've told you about already. We now want to look at the impact of the crisis, because knowing probability is one thing, but we have to then multiply that probability by what we think a crisis does in the economy. And so what we did was we assessed the effect of the current crisis as a benchmark for the benefits of regulation. And obviously that's an extreme scenario. Other crises might have been less costly than this one. So it will give an upper bound to the benefits of regulation. And the key background, this is a really good Bank of England paper by Hogarth and Supporter, 2001. They looked at financial crises and their costs, and you've got the economy going like this in its long-term trend. Then you get a financial crisis, and maybe eventually it comes back to trend. Okay. Now, a lot of work says the way to measure a cost of crisis is to just look at growth rates and to just say, well, how long does it take for the growth rate to get back? What Hogarth and Supporter argue is that it's much better to use the integral below trend growth in order to calculate the cost of crises. And that's the sort of approach that we do. And what we're going to highlight is that a recession is only part of the story. A recession is only part of the story because the capital stock may be lower forever as a consequence of a financial crisis. That's what we call scarring. The capital stock is hit permanently. So how do we work that out? Basically, we use the NIGEM global macroeconomic model. And in particular, we, although it doesn't actually need the model at this point, what we do need is the production function, okay? So in the NIGEM model, we have a production function. Q is output, K is capital, L is labor. And as you expect, a rising capital or a rising labor increases potential output, which is basically what the production function is telling us. And then we have various exponents based on technical progress, etc. And within that, the way that the financial effect impacts is via the use cost of capital. The use cost of capital will impact on the capital to output ratio because obviously the user cost is an input to the investment function. The higher the user cost of capital, the less firms want to invest, and that in turn will impact on the capital stock generally. And the user cost of capital in turn is driven by risk-free long real rates, but also by the borrowing margin charged either by banks, which we call Corp W, or by the bond market, what we call I-Prem, in order to reflect costs and risks. So the weighted average cost of capital, which enters the user cost and is the main determinant, is a function of the cost of equity, which is the earnings price ratio in the equity market, E over P, times the proportion of funding which is done by equity in the corporate sector, plus the rest of the financing, 1 minus B1T, times the weighted average of the long rate plus the bank margin, Corp W, where the weight C is the proportion of debt finance of the corporate sector, which is bank related, plus 1 minus C times the long rate plus the bond market premium, I-Prem. So that's the bond market financing of the corporate sector. So you can see logically that we're building up a weighted average cost of capital in there that in turn feeds into the user cost of capital. And debt finance is tax relieved, so we have 1 minus the corporate tax rate there as well. Yep?
I want to ask how basically it's so that after a crisis, very often the public sector debt is increasing, which is sort of post the crisis. But my question is, to what extent those indicators like bond market premium and take into account, or have they responded in the past to increases in public sector debt? Do they take into account those costs as well, which are related to public sector debt?
Well, I mean, that affects LRR.
In theory, it should, but empirically...
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interest in that question, I know. And I think on average, people do find a weak relationship between high fiscal deficits or high fiscal debts and your domestic long rate. And that would in turn impact on this. But what is probably, in this particular exercise, we're mainly focusing on the additions to the long real rate due to financial market impacts of the crisis. So that could help, that could boost the costs of a crisis, I agree, and therefore make the loss of capital stock even greater. Yeah, I agree with that. But we're not taking that into account in this exercise. And this is a chart we've already shown you, and what this is showing is this variable IPREM for the three different areas of the world, well, let's not say the world, three different areas of the OECD, which show the incredible rises in the corporate bond spread over 2007 to 2009. And what we would argue is that because of arbitrage and also because of the impact of risk aversion of the banks, that a similar sort of pattern would have happened to the CorpW variable in the corporate sector bank lending. But we will estimate that as well. And this is what we think happened. This is Ray Barrell's forecast when there was the financial crisis. So they started from this trend output here, which was based on their July 2008 forecast. You can see it already bends down because there was some concern that the crisis had already started, but it wasn't systemic at that point. What they think happened is that we got this step down in trend output, and you can see that we won't probably ever get back to the previous level of output that we thought we would. And reasons for that, firstly, Lehman's in particular, which is thought to, from the risk premium, the thing we've just seen in the previous chart, working through the used cost of capital, reduces the trend by 3 to 4%. Second point, that we thought there were gains in productivity from the banking sector, which are illusory. We think that's worth another 1 to 2%. And thirdly, there may be quite a lot of out-migration. We're thinking particularly of people from the new member states, probably not Estonia, that we thought might affect trend growth by 0.75%. So this, if you like, is the concept of the scar. You can see it's quite different from the sort of pattern that people generally expect, in the sense that you're rather going along here, and you can see that as you add up this integral over a very long period of time, then the value gets very high. And avoiding a crisis is not just a question of avoiding the recession, it's a question of avoiding the scar that reduces long-term output.
But then you basically assume that you estimated extremely precisely the potential output before the crisis, but there is a slight likelihood that you actually overestimated.
Yeah, I mean, you can see that we have the sort of fans like the Bank of England invented here, saying there's a possibility it might be up here or down here. But on balance, we think it's here. These are the 20% probability, 1 in 20, 5% probabilities up at the top and the bottom.
To interpret that trend line as potential?
It's an output projection. It's not necessarily trend GDP. It's what we expected output to do, if you like, in the previous forecast. There could still be an output gap that varies over time. Okay, so what we need to do now is to... we've worked out the costs because we've got the probability and we've got our estimate of the costs, which is that shown in that chart, and it's the integral below the line. The third ingredient, then, is to model the banking sector. And we've seen already that regulation reduces the likelihood of crises, and if we reduce the likelihood, we also reduce the cost on a probabilistic basis. On the other hand, there may be a negative impact on output, from regulation by borrowing costs, as I say, and also because regulation may raise the use of cost of capital. So you can see how that production function is really important. The production function is on the one hand telling us about the scar, on the other hand it's also going to tell us what the cost of regulation is. And the reason for that is if we have an effective tax on banks, then it has a real effect, which is widening the spreads. And that's exactly what I showed you also in my work with Haipin Zhu, where we got a positive and very significant sign on capital adequacy in interest margins. So what we do then is we model the effect of regulation on output in non-crisis periods, if you like, or rather all periods, by constructing a banking sector model, which NIGEM didn't have before, and building it in. And this is just for the UK, but our future work will probably look at the United States, Germany as well, and maybe the Eurozone. We'll see how that easy that is. And because it's the FSA, their preference, and the UK, their preference was to use risk-weighted capital adequacy, which means we're slightly inconsistent, but there is a very close correlation between risk-weighted capital adequacy and the LEV variable that we used in the LOGIT. Remember, we couldn't use anything else in the LOGIT because it was not available for other countries. The NIGEM model, which I understand may have been in the Estonian Central Bank at some point, I gather it isn't now, but you're always welcome to subscribe if you want, is a global macroeconomic model, in particular of, it spells out most European countries, I think, with individual models, and has some of these features. Supply and demand are separately spelled out with production functions, consumption, etc. Trade and capital account linkages occur between countries. There's a stock flow consistency in terms of investment and capital stock, for example, also borrowing and stock of loans, deposits, etc. There are quite strong wealth effects in the consumption function. And it's a DSGE, dynamic stochastic general equilibrium model with long run properties that are reasonable. The financial and exchange markets are forward looking, as is the wage bargain. And as we saw, the capital stock depends on user cost. It also depends on expectations of output, which is a fairly standard accelerator type effect. And the what is the effect if capital adequacy changes the spread? That's the interesting question. It's different between individuals and corporates. Individuals obviously are affected as well, households that is, because if the spread widens, then their income falls, okay? They get less deposit interest, and they pay more loan interest on their mortgages. So that changes real personal disposable income, and therefore they will change their timing of consumption. They may well delay consumption when the spread widens. And that in turn may induce sharp short-term reductions in output. But in the NIGEM model, the personal sector doesn't have a long-run effect. Eventually, things adjust and consumption gets back to its long-run trend. On the other hand, for the corporate sector, following the chart we showed you with the SCAR, the corporate sector has a permanent impact from a change in the spread, because it changes the user cost, it changes the equilibrium level of output and capital in a sustained manner. So you get both a short and a long run effect operating by the corporate sector. So then we embed in this DSG macro model a banking sector model, and we assume that banking activity has got a set of supply and demand curves, and as you would expect, demand for loans and deposits depends on income. It also depends on relative prices. So you know, your mortgage, you'll be more likely to take a mortgage with a higher income and a lower interest rate, etc. The supply, on the other hand, depends on cost of providing assets and the risks associated with those assets. And obviously, we're not identifying particularly, so we're getting a sort of reduced form relationship here, as you'll see in a minute. The banking sector then has four different assets. The first one is secured loans to individuals for mortgages with a certain borrowing cost. We have unsecured loans with consumer credit, which has a higher borrowing cost, credit cards and stuff. The banking sector lends to corporates with a certain cost, which is what we saw earlier, long run rate plus the margin on corporate loans. And the bank has liquid assets as well, the banking sector. And basically within those, we get capital adequacy falling out because that's the complement of those other variables. And this, obviously, the banking system has other stuff, but this is a way of summarising the behaviour of banks within the UK. We don't want the international work or anything like that incorporated. We want what's relevant to the UK in there. So then we estimate these equations for spreads, as well as the related equations, which I'm not showing you, for borrowing, lending, etc. But you can only introduce your capital adequacy at one point, and the logical way to do it, we thought, was to include it in the spreads equation. So we have here data from usually from the mid-80s until now for the corporate spread, Corp W, and the household spread, Lend W. And as I said, the sort of variables that are included in this case, this is the output gap, level of income minus capacity income. We've got insolvencies, which is an indicator of risk to the banks, which drives up the corporate spread. And then we've got capital adequacy, which enters in two ways. It enters here directly. Lev RR is the risk-adjusted capital adequacy, which is significant and positive. And then we also have what we call the inverse headroom, which is what you'll remember earlier, this chart here. This is headroom, the amount that banking capital adequacy is relative to the trigger ratio. So that's headroom, and we've got 1 over headroom as a variable in that equation. And as you'd expect, inverse headroom drives up the corporate wedge. The closer you are to head to trigger ratios, the more interest you want to charge in order to get away from it as quickly as possible. Household sector spread, on the other hand, a more dynamic equation, includes arrears, which is a risk indicator, as well as net wealth to personal income. And the capital adequacy of the household sector. You think the signs are wrong, perhaps it's because this is all in brackets here, and this is an error correction, right? So this is a dynamic equation, and all the signs are the opposite way to what you expect, okay? So this is actually a positive sign on capital adequacy, positive sign on arrears, and a negative sign on personal sector net wealth to income, which is what we expect from economics. And as I say, we also estimated equations for loan demand, for deposits, etc., using these spreads as inputs. And that meant in turn that capital adequacy would feed through the spreads into the quantities, but also directly into the investment function via the user cost of capital. So as I say, each spread feeds into the borrowing cost and then the credit volumes, and it has the right sign. We don't find a direct role for liquidity, on the other hand, which is calibrated instead based on our results for the United States. You know, we could try, but liquidity doesn't come in. And when you see that chart from the Bank of England showing how it went down to 1%, it's maybe not surprising, it's hard to detect. So we're finding these effects from actual data, right? We're not just making them up. We're saying that according to the data back to the 80s, capital adequacy did have an impact on spreads, and that's what we're going to use in our work. An assumption, as I say, is that there's a one-to-one relationship of the bank spread to the bond spread. So when Corp W widens, then so does IPRAM, which is the corporate bond minus government bond relationship. And then we have adjustment equations to ensure the balance sheet adds up and capital adds up. And obviously capital then feeds back, right back to the start of the process. Any questions? So now we just show a few charts which illustrate the results of the model. And the first one is, what if we tighten regulation very sharply without giving the banks time to respond, if you like? What this chart shows is the change in corporate borrowing costs if we raise capital by 1%, 2%, and 3%. And what you can see is that whereas the first two are kind of straightforward, a big rise in capital has this enormous non-linear effect up here. Okay, so you tell the banks you've got to raise your capital immediately by 3 percentage points without them having time to do anything, and they panic. They rise the margin by an enormous amount up here, and that is obviously likely to cause heavy credit rationing and a possible recession. So that's a warning about the short-term effects, that you have to maybe introduce this gradually rather than suddenly, or even, if you want to be cynical, if the government owns the banking system, then maybe it should give the banks some capital so that they can then fulfill the FSA's capital requirements. Whatever the mechanism for raising capital, the other charts I'm going to show you are based on assuming equal changes to target and actual capital, okay? What that means is that we're assuming that banks are able to keep up with the government, the FSA, the headroom. I mean, what's kicking the previous equation? What's kicking it here is this thing called inverse headroom, right, in the Corp W equation. The inverse headroom gets very small, or very large rather, because you're close to the trigger, and that's what is making them panic. In these cases, the inverse headroom and the non-inverse headroom is held constant. So what we're looking at is the long-run effect of a tightening of regulation on output. And what we can see is that there's a gradual build-up of the cost of regulation over time, and that's consistent with this idea that we raise the user cost of capital, and that in turn reduces the capital to output ratio and has a long run effect on the economy. So the rise in the spread, even if capital is kept in line with the trigger, is still going to impact negatively on the economy. And this, if you like, is the main offset to the benefit that we can see from not having this nasty scar on the economy in a probabilistic way following a banking crisis. So what we can then do is we can compare the gains from tighter regulation to the costs of regulation. And basically that's what we've already shown. The gains are the change in the probability of a crisis times the amount of lost output you get that previous diagram showing the scar. The costs are the regulatory impacts on output, looking at the long run rather than the short run, and we look then at the steady state impacts up to the year 2018. And what we can see here is impacts here on the borrowing costs first. Supposing we change capital and liquidity by 1, 2, 3 or 4%, then this is the change in Corp W, the corporate spread. And as you'd expect, it is boosted increasingly depending on how much we raise the capital and the liquidity requirement. And so that's an absolute change. We then show the percent change, which is different, in the user cost of capital. And you can see that we're talking quite significant percent changes in the user cost of capital. If, on the other hand, and this is calibrated, we only change the liquidity, again, you get a boost, but it's somewhat less for any given amount than the boost from the capital. And that relates to, on the one hand, the effect of liquidity that relates to the calibrated effect of liquidity in the equations that we've shown you, even though they actually only have a capital in them. So what we can then do is put all this together and show the long-run impacts of regulation on output. And as you can see, whatever the impact, it settles down by about 2018 at whatever level it's going to be in the long term. And we're talking, although the percentages don't seem high on this side, we're saying that this is a sustained long-term impact. So it goes on, you know, for a long period after that. We're evaluating it up to 2018. So what does it look like when we put together the costs and the benefits? And this is the chart that has aroused a lot of interest. Basically what this is doing is it's accumulating using a bond yield to discount it, the changes, the net present value of the changes in GDP relative to the percentage point increases in capital adequacy and in liquidity. Okay, so what is it saying? It's saying there's two offsetting components here. Okay, so this is MPV delta Y, and this is delta lev and lig. So for each of these blocks, what we've actually got is a positive component and a negative component. And the positive component is the benefit in terms of reducing the probability of a financial crisis multiplied by the cost of having a financial crisis. And obviously, the higher that gets, that is going to tend to increase, because we saw earlier in this chart, I'm not standing in front, I don't want to see it. What we saw earlier is that we get a cumulative benefit the more we raise capital adequacy, although obviously that's going to come to an end eventually, because the probability of a crisis is going to become negligible. So the benefit that you get in excess is going to eventually fall off. What you've also got, on the other hand, are these blocks down here, which are the costs of financial instability, of tighter regulation, and what we saw is that those may increase from this chart here. That they get greater the more that you raise capital adequacy and liquidity standards. So the combination of these blocks which are positive and these blocks which are negative is what gives you this chart here. And what it's saying is that if you want to have no cost but no benefit, you could go up to 6 or 6.5% higher capital and liquidity, that's percentage points. If you want to maximize the benefit to the economy, you could do 3 percentage points. If you want to go beyond 6.5, then you're imposing a net cost on the economy. And, you know, let's not say that these are the most perfect, calibrated, accurate calculations. They're kind of indicative. They depend on various assumptions, but on the other hand, I think we would argue that they're at least showing the sort of pattern that one might expect. And in a sense, this is good news for central banks and regulators, if they're right, because they're saying that we can actually benefit the economy overall by raising and tightening our financial regulation standards. Not just because it saves us from sleepless nights, but because it has a genuine benefit at a macroeconomic level. Any questions or comments there?
You just mentioned that actually it points down to estimation and basically the assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, isn't it the case that costs are somewhat more certain in terms of confidence intervals and the benefits?
Yeah, that's one possibility. One could make some sort of, how should we put it, a confidence interval on these things. That could be quite an interesting thing to do. Another thing which I think was done, which I don't have here to illustrate, is that if there is a net negative impact on the economy of uncertainty, right, the volatility in itself is bad because, you know, it makes people put off consumption, and you may actually have a little excess up here on a sort of general equilibrium basis that might boost it further. But yeah, there are various considerations like those that you could take into account. So just to conclude, lax regulation, we're arguing, raises the risk of a crisis. Basically, that's what we've seen since 2000. And raising capital adequacy and introducing binding liquidity will be beneficial if they reduce the probability of a financial crisis. But with a caveat that they have costs. The cost is any effective banking regulation is a tax. So the regulations may reduce output through impacts on borrowing costs for households and companies. And we were talking earlier about Modigliani Miller. Modigliani Miller, of course, says that capital corporate financial structure has no impact if we rule out bankruptcy costs and we rule out taxes. So I think both of those are wrong. And if we argue that this is a tax, then again, it's justifiable that it would have an impact. Anyone who really, really believes in Modigliani Miller would say there are only benefits and no costs, although they might argue, on the other hand, that how can it affect the probability of crisis even? There's been a lot of debate on this. We find a short-run impact on consumption, which is the household sector thing, but also a short- and long-run impact on investment. So impact of a crisis has got those two components. You get the initial bulge, mainly consumption. The long run is the investment and the capital stock, of course. The estimates of the impacts on costs are an upper bound. This is one caveat, because the structure of portfolios as well as relative prices may change. So that's one difficulty with our work. regulation may change the structure of portfolios. Another point which we haven't made here, but which one can make, is that it might also lead to disintermediation outside the financial system that is regulated, the so-called boundary problem. So that again might change the costs and benefits. It might reduce the costs because there's more non-regulated intermediation. On the other hand, it might reduce the benefits because the non-regulated intermediation is probably more risky. When we tighten capital adequacy by 1%, banks contract their balance sheet, this is an interesting one, by 1.2%, but they also reduce riskiness by 1.6%, the risk-weighted assets. And that's contrary, we argue, to Modigliani Miller, because they've changed the risk structure in our model when capital adequacy is raised. What we've shown also implies that we need to be cautious about rapid regulatory tightening, because margins may jump, so one needs to avoid that. And also there's a positive net benefit from 2 to 6, and that increases welfare overall. Meanwhile, we don't show the chart for this, separate tightening of capital or liquidity ratios may offer a benefit up to 10 percentage points. But I think the authorities are probably better advised to raise both capital and liquidity. My guess is that they would do it asymmetrically, actually, that they would raise capital by maybe 2% and raise liquidity by 6 or even more, because liquidity has got so low. And you can do any of those calibrations using this this model. So, and obviously what I was saying earlier about further research into crisis estimation also has an impact on this, because these results, like on the customer deposit to loan, net liquid assets, will have an impact on these results. We could redo those results with net liquid assets, for instance. We could also redo these results with the customer deposit to loan ratio included, and that's something we're working on at the moment. This one is particularly interesting in this context, the cross-country crisis variable. Why is that? Because if cross-country crises have an impact on your own domestic probability of crises, then your incentive is not just to tighten your own capital adequacy, but it's to go to Basel and make sure everyone else tightens their capital adequacy and liquidity as well, right? Because as soon as you get cross-country spillovers, you need to persuade everyone else to reduce their probability of crisis as well. Otherwise, you're not getting the maximum benefit. And there's an interesting point there, that the one that you really want to persuade to tighten regulation are the Americans, because they're the ones with the biggest impact on everybody else. On the other hand, the Americans, if they wanted, could ask for some kind of side payment, is one argument that one can make. But this cross-country crisis variable is really important, because that result, in a sense, justifies people going to Basel and trying to sort things out on a cross-country basis, even using this kind of simple methodology. So, are there any questions on this? This is the paper, if you, and it's, there's a link on the website as well.
Let's say, I'm clarifying. Basically, what we did was that we made bank loans a little bit more expensive.
Yeah.
And ever since they made the...
Well, deposits are cheaper as well. You know,
I mean,
the spread.
Bonds, corporate bonds,
No, they don't. We're assuming that arbitrage exists, and so the corporate bond spread would rise as well, and you can argue about that. you could say, well, why should they? Or maybe they would rise a little bit less. But, you know, if you think about it, supposing bank loans get more expensive, that means that issuers are going to go to the corporate bond market, and that could drive up the spread in the end as well. So that's how you get the rising used cost of capital. But you might still argue that it shouldn't be that, that we're pushing it to the limit by saying it goes up the same amount. Maybe one could argue that the rising corporate bond spreads will actually attenuate the rising bank loan spreads because there's less demand for bank loans. But on the other hand, the corporate bond spread will not be unchanged either. You know, that's the way we could argue, I think. Anybody else? Okay, well, I think that's the end of the second day, and I hope you've heard some useful things.